Working Cows Podcast, episode 50.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy everybody, it's Clay Connery. Here we are, episode 50. I've been building up to it for a long time. Joel Salatin is my guest today. Joel is the editor of the Stockman Grass Farmer. He writes the Pitchfork Pulpit for Mother Earth News, as well as numerous guest articles for Acres USA and other publications. We'll have links to all that up at today's show notes page, possibly the most robust show notes page in the history of the Working Cows podcast, with Joel Salatin here as our guest today. One note on this interview, Joel does live on a ranch in the country in Virginia. There was some crackling on his line, but there's some gold here with Joel, so I really want to just encourage you to hang on through the end and check out this interview with Joel Salatin. So, Joel, thanks for joining me on the Working Cows podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
I appreciate you taking the time to sit down with me today. And as I thought about what I would want to talk to you about, I was wondering how you would approach a discussion with a rancher if you met him in passing or sat next to him on an airplane, and he revealed that he was struggling with ranch profitability. What kind of recommendations would you make, and how would you encourage him to tackle those issues?
Well, the first thing I would ask him is if he is doing what we call intensive control grazing or mob grazing or whatever you want to call it. But if he's moving his animals, routinely, that would be the first question, because that would indicate, a level of management. And if he is, then of course we talk about how to do that better. If he's not, then we start talking about the advantages of it.
Why is that the place you would start?
Yeah, well, the reason is because if the cows stay in the same place for very long, and our rule of thumb is 24 hours, more than 24 hours is too long. I mean, unless you're going on vacation or you're wanting to do something special, but the general rule, moving every day is critical. Because you get the highest utilization and the greatest benefit from the pasture, as opposed to continuous grazing or anything less. What happens is when they stay longer in an area, they walk more, they louse more, and what they step on and lie on, they don't eat. So actually, a cow eats with five mouths, one mouth, 4 feet. And of course their body, what they lie down on. And so by going to a very highly managed, movement, you minimize the wastage that occurs with, walking around. Of course, you also minimize the calorie requirement from long walks, because you've got things, tighter. And so a lot of things happen when you go to a daily move. Whenever anybody asks me about, problem, whether it's weeds, profitability, whatever, I always ask, well, are you moving them every day? Because if you're moving them every day, that means you have control mechanisms, i.e. fencing. You have watering systems, water pipe, mobile, some sort of a able water pipe. And you have a level of management that is solving a tremendous amount of problems. When you confine them like that tightly to mimic what nature does with wolves and predation, what happens is that they eat much more aggressively, so they actually eat faster, and fill up quicker and spend more time ruminating. You know, a cow does not make meat or milk when they're chewing. They only make, I mean, when they're eating. They only make milk when they're, or meat when they're ruminating. So you want to maximize the rumination time and minimize the grazing time. And so the daily move means that they're going to be able to ingest what they want to eat much quicker because it's fresh, it's new, it's, you know, it's thicker, and they can fill up quicker, which means they're going to maximize their rumination time.
What are some of the challenges that come along with that? You mentioned water, you mentioned fencing. What are some of the challenges that come along with daily moves, and how have you guys overcome those?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first challenge, of course, is water. And fortunately, now we have lots of water options, you know, with pipe. I mean, black plastic pipe is almost a miracle compared to, you know, somebody from 100 years ago. They just think it was unbelievable. But we can now, you know, with a subsoiler, we can lay pipe very cheaply, very efficiently. And, you know, so you can pump it if you're on flat country. If you have some, here on our home farm, we have a lot of elevation because we're kind of up against the edge of a mountain. Now in Colorado, you wouldn't call it a mountain because it's got trees on it, but here in the East, we call it a mountain. And, so permaculture style, we've built some ponds up there in some valleys, and, we catch winter runoff in, you know, snows or hurricanes or whatever. And then we have an 8-mile grid of water line that goes out over the farm. So we have, gravity fed pressure water, over the whole place. I mean, that's taken years to finally get it all in and get it done. But that is a tremendous, asset to be able to have, non-pumped gravity fed water. If you don't have a lot of elevation, you know, you can dribble water up into a cistern. You can put it on stilts. You can pull it up in a tree. You can make a turkey nest pond on a high spot. The idea is to dribble water into a high spot, and then you have flow that can go rapidly when the herd comes to drink. Because they don't drink. In a 24-hour period, they don't drink the same amount every hour. They come in waves, and so you need to be able to have a flow that can handle, you know, the heavy, whatever, 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock drinking cycle. And so, water, of course, is the first deal. The second one is control, otherwise known as fencing. And there again, we have tremendous high-tech solutions to problems that they had years ago. We have electric fencing, so that allows us to put a steering wheel, a brake, and an accelerator on that four-legged pruning sauerkraut vat, and steer that cow herd around the pasture with the same precision as you would a zero-turn mower on a golf course. It's pretty cool. We've never been able to do that before in human history. So you've got control. Depending on where you are, you may or may not need some sort of shelter. And we here in the East, with our high humidity and hot summers, for sure the animals do a lot better if they do have shelter. Obviously, you can use trees, but the problem with trees is they get all the pasture manure. You translocate the nutrients from the pasture out under the trees where you really don't need it. And so what we have is portable shade mobiles. We make them from nursery shade cloth on expanded wagon chassis, real cheap, and we can hook them together and move them around the pasture. And that way we can place those pasture droppings, the manure and urine, we can place it on, you know, rock spots or brambles or brush or something, and get that heavy impaction along with the manure and urine. And we can, you know, we can take a poor spot and turn it into, you know, beautiful pasture in, you know, in just one day's impact application there. It's pretty dramatic. So, you know, those are all the things and the elements that are needed in order to be able to move them around the landscape like this.
So what about, what if they raise some objections and say, you know, that doesn't work here, or I can't, you know, whatever the objection might be, how would you answer some of the common objections you hear to this method of moving cows around?
Yeah, well, the most common objection, of course, is that it takes too much time. I don't have time to move my cows every day. I mean, if I did that, I'd be out there, all the time, wouldn't get anything else done. And that's because the paradigm, you know, the phrase move cows, for the average person, move cows means that you spend all day with 3 4-wheelers, 2 pickup trucks, all the cousins and the aunts and the uncles and whatever else trying to get these things herded up, and maybe you still didn't get them all because there's one stuck back in the brush somewhere. And that, you know, that's the mental picture that automatically comes when you say move cows. When I say move cows, I mean you walk out there, you call them because you're moving them at the same time every day. They get their creatures of habit. They listen at 4 o'clock every day. If somebody called you to a bowl of ice cream at 4 o'clock every day, about 3:45, you'd probably start, you know, sitting up, and your ears would twitch a little bit, and you might flick your tail some, right? And so by moving them every day like this, they get real used to it. You don't have to herd them anywhere. You don't have to drive them anywhere. You just call them, and they follow you. They'll follow us into a corral, follow us into another paddock, follow us down a lane a mile away. They will follow you, just about anywhere if you have established the management routine. So, it doesn't take that much time. And for us, you know, our county, cow day average is 80 cow days per acre, is our county average here in Augusta County, Virginia. And on our farm, we generally, we're averaging a little over 400 cow days per acre. And on our rental farms where we haven't done this as long, you know, we're about, you know, 240. That's still 3 times the county average. Well, let me ask you, you know, what would it be worth to you if you could triple your production, you know, without buying any fertilizer, without buying any more machinery, without putting up any more buildings, if all you did was go out there? And you start putting some pencil to that, and suddenly, you know, you're looking at, I mean, we've certainly computed it here, we're looking at a return to labor of you know, $60 to $70 an hour, the amount of time that we spend moving, because it so increases the production per acre. What a farmer gets paid for is converting biomass, solar collected biomass, into a marketable thing, whether it's, you know, lamb, beef, milk, whatever. And that's what the farmer gets paid for. So if we can increase production without increasing any overhead, no more taxes, no more insurance, no more buildings, no more equipment, suddenly that time becomes extremely valuable. Second thing I would say is that most farmers and ranchers that have cows, at least the ones that I know, spend the lion's share of their time looking for animals. You know, cows are calving. Well, I wonder where that cow is. And around here during calving time, you know, the average farmer with a pretty good-sized herd, you know, it's anything over 100 cows, is going to spend a couple hours, 3 hours a day just out there, you know, looking for cows in this 100-acre, you know, 150-acre field. Out west, of course, it's even more. And so by moving them every day, we see them every day, and they actually, and they're in these smaller paddocks, so we can actually find the cows. If you start putting in a few, you know, a couple 3 hours here, a couple 3 hours there looking for cows, suddenly those, you know, that hour a day moving them, prorated out, suddenly becomes the best, you know, the best investment, the best cost saving you could ever do. So the whole time argument, which is the biggest one, falls away as soon as you start down that path. Of course, you know, there are all sorts of arguments about, well, I don't have water. Well, there's, you know, you can build ponds, you can do all sorts of cool things to develop water resources. They can say, well, you know, my cows won't stay in if I use electric fence. Well, that's not the cow's fault. That's your fault for not putting up electric fence that works. You can get junky electric fence energizers and set it up poorly, or you can get good ones and set it up correctly. And so, I mean, there's no end to the creativity people can exhibit in making something not work.
Yeah, especially when they don't want it to work. That's
something
right.
I've
found to be the case for sure. And then, so let's go down the wormhole here. What are some other things that people could be doing, maybe even out farther outside the box, as far as increasing profitability of the ranch business as a whole?
You mean like things like direct marketing
you can add, you can go as far down the wormhole as you want. You know, I think that,
I'll tell you, I mean, once you're moving them every day and you have your management in a good place, well, there's a couple things that can really make a big difference. And we've certainly done both of them and they're fantastic. One is irrigation. And, you know, the K-line irrigation system is fantastic. But we don't want to pump from aquifers because that's the commons. If everybody sticks a straw in the aquifer and starts sucking, pretty soon you don't have an aquifer or a stream or a creek or whatever. So, so this presupposes that we've built, impoundments, water. You know, the Australian water guru, P.A. Yeoman, who wrote, Water for Every Farm in the late, whatever, 1950s. Is still considered, you know, the number one, you know, water guy in the world. He's been long deceased, but, his whole deal, he said every farmer should aspire to two things. One is, eliminate surface runoff, because if you have surface runoff, that means the commons is full. If you're getting water running across the surface of the soil, that means the soil has absorbed all it can and that water is just heading downhill. Away and causing flooding problems downhill. So by impounding that water, you're actually not depleting the commons. You're actually adding to the commons because that commons is going to stick around like money in a bank, to be, you know, released during a drought, during a dry time, which is beneficial for everybody and the hydrology and waterfowl and all that sort of thing. So we have, over the years, every time we get a little bit of extra money, we build another pond, build another pond, build another pond, to the point that we can now, on most of our home farm acreage, we can now get 6 to 8 inches of water on it, in a time. And, I mean, not all at once, but, you know, spread out over a couple of months. And that really, really builds in some forgiveness for dry times because this wet, dry cycle. I mean, right now we're in a wet cycle. I mean, we can't, everything's just wet, wet, Hurricane Florence and all this, you know, and we're just soaking wet. But, it's wonderful to see our ponds full now. And when it goes dry, then we'll have water to irrigate. We actually had those ponds almost dry just 2 months ago. And that water was used for irrigation. So we were able to make another whole grazing or another whole, hay cycle that we would not have had we been unable to irrigate with the little, New Zealand K-line system. The second thing beyond irrigation is is what's called pasture cropping. That also comes from Australia. There's a guy there named Colin Seiss who has about 2,000 farmers doing this. And he basically wedded no-till with holistic management. So he's got a flock of 3,000 or 4,000 sheep. And he's a grain farmer. He raises wheat, barley, oats, things like that. And so he wanted to quit, you know, using chemicals and fertilizer and all this stuff for his grain. So he uses this flock of sheep to go in and strategically weaken the perennial, the prairie basically, weaken it, by overgrazing it. So you graze it. And then you plant, and then you graze it again before germination. You use a no-till drill. You plant, you graze it again right before the seeds germinate. And what you've done is you've actually created just a window of opportunity for these annuals to jump up through this weakened sod and get ahead of it. And when that happens, then as the annual grows, whether it's corn, you know, corn, beans, oats, cowpeas, whatever, as that annual grows, it shades out the sod, the grass, the prairie, and keeps it kind of retarded as a living mulch underneath it. And then when you harvest your grain crop, whether you graze it or whether you, harvest the grain, however you harvest it, then the sod is there. As soon as it gets light, as soon as it gets enough light in it, then it, of course, jumps on, and you have not done any tillage. And he does this about once every, I think, 5 to 7 years with small grains, and doesn't have to use any fertilizers because the perennial with the livestock runs the fertility engine for the once every 5 to 7 year crop pull off. Now, we have not done it to take off, the grain crops. What we have done it with is, Sudex, Milo, corn, cowpeas, and we've grazed it with cattle. And, so in the summertime when it's hot and dry in these annuals, these summer, heat loving, drought tolerant annuals can get a jump on things, you can easily get another, 200, 300, 400, maybe even 600 cow days per acre off of a path with lush annuals. And there's no tillage, no plow, no anything, just using the animals as a prep tool to give you a window of planting opportunity. Those are the irrigation and the pasture cropping are two things that are, I think they're going to continue to accelerate in the U.S. from New Zealand and Australia.
How about your stock density? How much of a role is that playing in what you guys are accomplishing with your grazing methods?
Well, the stock density as your forage increases in carrying capacity and thickness, height, quality, whatever, then of course your stock density can increase as well. And so, for example, on stockpiled fescue, stockpiled forages here, we have actually gotten as high, I think the highest we've ever gotten is, now this is on a perennial, this is on just grass, for winter, winter stockpile, is the highest we've ever gotten is 200 cow days per acre. That would be on one pass. That doesn't count all the summer passes, but that would be just on one pass in the winter. 200 cow days per acre. So, that you're talking about, putting 200 cows on 1 acre for a day, or 400 cows on 2 acres. And boy, if you can get that kind of, density, you can save a lot of hay. I mean, the single biggest cost factor in any livestock operation is hay. And so in our area, the average farm feeds hay for 120 days a year. And that 120 days a year is consistent from Florida to Saskatchewan. Those are pretty consistent, all the way. And we feed hay on average for 40 days a year. So cutting it from 120 to 40, cuts you about anywhere from $100 to $150 worth of direct expense in keeping a cow. Remember, you don't make a profit on a cow until she is paid for herself and paid for her calf. In other words, her calf has to carry her whole expense, which includes her winter carrying expense. And so the whole cost of hay to keep that cow alive through the winter, that has to come straight off of the value of that calf when it's sold before you make a dime. So if you can drop $100, $150 off of the wintering cost of a cow, that goes straight to your bottom line when the calf is sold.
Say you're sitting next to this rancher and he's all in. He's bit hit hook, line, and sinker, and he's willing to go way down the wormhole and start thinking about other species and things like that. What kind of a role does that play in increasing profitability as far as you have seen it on your operation?
Well, for sure, the more, diversity is a good thing, to a point. I mean, you can't over diversify to the point where, nothing is very efficient. But, without that, certainly more different species eat different things. I mean, sheep eat different things than cows. Goats eat different things than sheep. Goats eat different things than cows. Horses, whatever, chickens, pigs. And so as we have added, so we now have, ducks, sheep, chickens, turkeys, cows, pigs. I think I got it all. And the cumulative value of those different species, you know, 1 + 1 = 3. You know, a lot of people like to talk about all the bison and the and grazing. You know, grazing gurus certainly talk about, you know, bison and the old you know, pre-European animal choreography, migratory choreography in the U.S. But a lot of people don't talk about the birds that were here. I mean, Audubon sat under a tree in 1800. He wrote in his diary, said, "I couldn't see the sun for 3 days because the flock of birds that flew over, I think they were passenger pigeons, the flock of birds that flew over blocked out the sun for 3 days. Now, you know, I've seen some pretty big flocks of birds, but I certainly haven't seen anything that would approach blocking out the sun for 3 days. And so the level, the number of birds, from prairie chickens, pheasants, turkeys, passenger pigeons, all of these birds that were here, along with the bison, that's what sanitized these fields, and they ate the you know, they spread the seeds, did all sorts of cool things. This was all done way before John Deere plowing and all that. I mean, the fact that 500 years ago, North America grew more food than it does today with plows, John Deere's, and chemical fertilizer should sober up anyone, you know, drunk on hubris that we have actually accomplished a lot. What we've accomplished is actually, you know, a feeling of productivity. But when you measure everything in aggregate, soil loss, you know, a dead zone the size of Rhode Island in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, think about that. A Rhode Island-sized piece of the ocean is completely dead and unproductive. How much food could have been was produced in there before it turned into a dead zone from the runoff, from the chemical runoff and the pesticide and fertilizer residues running down the Mississippi River? So, you know, our productivity, quote unquote, has come at massive cost, and in aggregate is not as good as the total productivity that was here before the Europeans came. And so I think it's important for us to study the templates that were here that made things so productive, and the symbiosis between herbivores and birds, from the egret on the rhino's nose to the, you know, to the cuckoos and the kangaroos in Australia. You know, the bird herbivore symbiosis is one of the most common and powerful synergistic relationships in nature, and I think that we talk a lot about, you know, cattle. We need to talk about bringing the birds out on the range too. That's chickens and turkeys.
And what kind of benefits are you guys seeing as far as the chickens and turkeys? I'm assuming it's economic, but there's got to be ecologic benefit there too, I'm guessing, as far as what you guys are seeing.
Yeah. If you want a triple production on an acre real quick, you just run some chickens and turkeys across it, and it'll be triple production. I mean, these guys, not only do they do some interesting work, physically with their feet scratching, but I mean, their manure is incredibly beneficial and has a long tail on it. You know, more worms, more soil life, abundant forage. And of course, if you're direct marketing, it gives you another item to sell. If you're gonna direct market anything, the more items you can have to create the one-stop shop, allows you to leverage your customers so that your customers are not just buying, they're not just buying alpacas or not just buying, you know, beef or whatever. They're buying a multitude of things that allows you to turn a $50 customer into a $1,000 customer because they have a lot more options, you know, to buy. Once you have a customer and they like you and they're loyal to you, they're looking around saying, well, you know, what else can I get from you? And so that kind of leveraging is a big deal.
I could see some people being opposed to the idea of chickens And let's just talk a little bit about, maybe people aren't familiar with how you guys are handling chickens in the pasture. So can we touch on that first, and then we'll move on to maybe an objection to chickens?
Sure. Well, we do a couple of kinds of chickens. The one we're most known for, of course, is the pastured broiler. And that's, of course, a meat chicken. It's the same chicken as Tyson's or, you know, Cargill or Pilgrim's Pride uses. It's the same genetic, same bird, but we raise them out in portable floorless shelters on the pasture that we move every day. So one person, without starting an engine, one person can move 5,000 chickens in an hour. It's very, very efficient. We just move them right along in these little floorless field shelters. And, the field shelters, of course, protect them from predators because they go out at, you know, 3 weeks or before. They're very, very small. And so, they're completely surrounded for weather protection, predator protection in these little, floorless boxes, basically. And we just move them along the pasture. That's where we do the broilers. The laying chickens, we have two models for the laying chickens. One is the Eggmobile, and the Eggmobile is a rubber-tired hen house. We can hook two together and put 800 laying hens in there and follow a herd of cows. And if we follow them at about 3 days, the fly larvae are big enough by that time for the chickens to eat. And so the chickens scratch through the cow patties. Now, these chickens are completely free-range. There's no fencing, no nothing. They're completely free-range. And they go out about 200 yards from the Eggmobile, so they'll cover in a day, they'll cover a circle that's 400 yards in diameter, which is a pretty big circle, and they will attack every cow patty, eat and scratch it into the soil so it spreads way out, gives you a lot more fertility, and they'll eat the fly larvae out so that they basically sanitize, and in the middle of the summer when it's hot, you've got grasshoppers and crickets. They, of course, eat grasshoppers and crickets and turn those into eggs. So the idea here is that you're actually stacking. These are not competitive enterprises on the pasture. They are complementary. You're not taking production away from the cattle to do this. You're actually adding it to the fertility and the complementarity of the birds that they bring. The other laying hen model, besides the Eggmobile, is what we call the Millennium Feathernet, which is on skids, and we just move it every 3 days. It's surrounded by electrified netting from Premier, and we give them a quarter acre, 1,000 birds. We give them a quarter acre every 3 days. We move them every 3 days and move them across the pasture. And when the grass gets real tall, then we bring the cows in to knock it back because the chickens like short grass. Short grass tends to reduce predators and make the netting go in easier, all sorts of good reasons to do that. And then, of course, we have the turkeys. And the turkeys are raised pretty much the same way as the Millennium Feathernet, although they get more room, same type of netting, but just a nursery shade cloth, simple shelter that we call the Gobbledygo. And we move them every day along the field as well. So there's a lot of stuff, you know, moving around. It's not stationary housing. It's completely, mobile, which means you can move it from field to field, farm to farm, location to location. And you don't have to own the land that it's on. Your whole farm can be completely mobile and disconnected from the land, which creates an opportunity to get in. For a person who has no capital and wants to get in, you don't have to buy buildings and land and machinery in order to get in, which is, you know, a big deal.
Yeah, that definitely kind of transitions well into what I was thinking of as far as the objection that maybe similar to the I don't have time to move my cows every day. Somebody's thinking, I don't really want to manage another whole business of these chickens. Yeah, the soil health benefits sound great, but this other business that I would have to manage starts to seem a little bit intimidating. I'm thinking of maybe a custom grazing situation for chickens where somebody could come in behind your cows on your land and graze their chickens, and they benefit, you benefit, and ultimately the end consumer benefits with a healthier chicken. Is that a reality?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of my books that I wrote is Fiefdoms, fiefdoms for farmers, And the whole idea there is building collaborative partnerships, because yeah, most of us don't like to do things. Obviously, you know, look, if you're going to direct market cows and chickens, it's a natural thing to team up with somebody that's doing produce, for example. And, you know, a produce CSA has already got customers that are not going to the supermarket. They want good food. And so, you team up with somebody like that. They already have a customer base. I mean, it's a no-brainer to add a protein base to, you know, an existing produce CSA, or vice versa. Same deal. So, yes, these collaborative enterprises can be developed, and you know, when we say this is what the land needs, I'm not assuming that one person you know, does all the different things on the same piece of property. I'm saying, you know, we build a team, we create partnerships, and we can build numerous enterprises. I haven't been on a farm in the world, and I've been on a lot of them, but I've never been on a farm in the world that is fully leveraging its resource base. But you know, when you say, well, you know, this farm could quintuple its income, the average farmer gets all, oh no, you can't, I'm already working 80 hours a week. What do you want me to do? Work 100, you know, and I'm 60 and blah, 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 blah. I'm not saying you have to do it. I'm just saying it can be done using the same resource base as you're currently using. You just use it in different ways and use it more efficiently.
We've talked a lot about things that people can do, can add to what they're already doing. They can start moving their cows more regularly. They can increase the stock density. They can add new species. We've touched a little bit on the direct marketing. I'm not going to continue down that path as thoroughly as we did the other ones. There's some great documentaries and great other things that do a good job of kind of showing what you guys are doing there. And they'll be linked in the show notes page at workingcows.net/50. Workingcows.net/50. We'll have a show notes page. We'll link to Joel's books. We'll link to some of the things he's mentioned here as far as different systems. And I'll link to some of my favorite documentaries with Joel that have touched on what he's doing there. But what I would like to talk about, rather than continuing down the path of what people can add to what they're already doing, is maybe we could talk about some of the things that you guys have taken out of what traditional American agriculture is doing. And when I'm referring to that, I'm thinking about the chemicals and some of those different things that you guys have removed out, which is also going to increase profitability, if I understand how that all relates to itself correctly.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think if we want to delve into that, it's a great question. So, you know, we haven't bought a bag of chemical fertilizer in 60 years. We haven't planted a seed, except for those couple pasture cropping experiments. And we will do more of that. We're not done with that. We just didn't do it this year. But essentially we haven't planted seeds for 60 years either. We focused on managing the stock and feeding the soil, trying to get the soil done, which the number one way is, of course, to move the cows every day so that the forage, you know, builds up a head of steam before you come back and graze it. But beyond that, when we do feed hay, we feed it under a roof, just a shed. It's not a sided barn or anything. It's just a awning, a shed roof. And so the big investment that we make that, you know, in deference to the fertilizer, yes, we don't buy all the fertilizer, all the chemicals, all that stuff. We don't buy any herbicides or anything like that. What we do invest in is carbon. And so we have a lot of forest here, and a lot of that forest is weedy, it's diseased, crooked trees, dead trees, overgrown, junky-type trees, and then we have some really, really great trees. And so I'm a big believer in kind of the permaculture idea that we need more forest and fewer trees. The problem in the U.S. is that our forests are weedy. They're way too confined. Way too many stems or stalks per acre, and so we need to thin them down. And the trees will grow a lot better. You don't have the fire issues, and you can graze and through them as well. And so so we have an industrial chipper. Wood chipper that we use, and we work in the woods and we chip. And so we'll use in a winter, you know, we'll use the equivalent of 20 tractor trailer loads of wood chips. But, you know, we're able to cover pretty much the whole, outfit, the whole farm with, compost. And, so we feed in this open-sided shed, and we use wood chips to absorb the bedding under the roof. And, it's just like, we call it a carbonaceous diaper. And it builds up as deep as 4 feet deep. So the hay bunks are made so we can raise them vertically. Now you could have a big free span shed and use, just round bale feeders in there and move them around, week to week. The point is though that the animals are, you're able to protect the manure and urine instead of having it, get vaporized or leached during the, during the spring thaw period, the heavy, water time of January, February, and early March before spring green up when the soil begins to wake up and work and metabolize these nutrients. We want to hold them, and protect them so we don't lose them. And, so we do that. We add corn to it. The corn ferments in that bedding pack because the cows are tromping out the oxygen and it's anaerobic. When the cows come back out to begin grazing again in the spring, then we put the pigs in, and the pigs then seek the fermented corn, and in the process, they fluff it all up and aerate it, convert it from anaerobic fermentation to aerobic decomposition, and that aerobic compost then, when the pigs are done in 4 to 6 weeks, then that aerobic compost we spread on the field, that becomes our fertilizer program. So while we're not buying the chemicals and all that, we are investing time and energy in a carbon economy that essentially mimics the kind, pre-European, nobody brought on the Great Prairies by putting down 10-10-10 fertilizer. those were built with carbon running through the bison, coming out on the prairie, and of course the sloughed off roots from the root mass. So we now have the ability to integrate our forestal biomass with our open land biomass and get this tremendous carbon injection that brings our organic matter up. So in 60 years, our farm has gone from an average of 1% organic matter to 8% organic matter. And when you realize that every percent increase in organic matter increases the water holding capacity of the soil 20,000 gallons per acre. So if you go from 1% OM to 2% OM, you've just increased your water holding capacity 20,000 gallons per acre. So from 1 to 8%, that's a 7 percentage point increase times 20,000 is 140,000 gallons of water that we can now hold per acre that we couldn't hold 60 years ago. That makes a huge difference. Both in a wet time when you're getting a lot of moisture, you want to hold on to it, and in a dry time when you want that moisture in your inventory so it can be slow released into the dry time.
I'm really glad you remembered that 20,000 per acre number, because I had heard it recently and I was going to have to Google what it was to find that out. So I was glad you had that. We're going to have sunshine, but we're not always going to have water. And if we can find a way to trap more water, so that root mass has something to feed on to turn that sunshine into, edible plant matter, that's what we got to do. That's our main resource we're managing is water. And, it's a really incredible, return on investment that you have shared with us. Another thing I think you're not doing is chemical application on the cattle themselves. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. Yeah, we don't vaccinate, we don't medicate, we don't do anything. But there again, it's not like we sit on our hands. So we put our money, rather than vet bills and chemicals and vaccinations and all that, we put our money in minerals. What kind of minerals? So we use Icelandic. It's expensive. It's Icelandic geothermally dried seaweed kelp. Ascophyllum nodosum is what they grow up there around Iceland. They actually harvest it with great big boom things that almost look like a haybine that goes out across the ocean at low tide, and they have their fields, and it's quite a amazing thing. But it's a naturally chelated when they geothermally dry it, and it's just brilliant green. It smells just like the ocean. You could eat it. So we use that. We use C90 sea salt, just dehydrated ocean water, and then we use Fertrell's poultry NutriBalancer, which is an organic food grade soft rock phosphate and kelp and other things in it. We mix those three together, one unit, as a general rule, we probably feed, I'm going to say, five times as much mineral, and I mean dollars, so we're, a lot, like 30, 40 bucks a season per head, in mineral, but, we have over 1,000 head of cattle. We had, three cases of pink eye this year. We just don't have a vet bill, even with that many animals. And so I would much rather, put my money in mineral and keep them really up and healthy than have, remedial stuff. And the cost of the vet bill, often the vet is, or all that remedial stuff, it's actually not the cost of the vet or the medication. It's the time cost, the stress cost on you and the animal of running them through the head gate and doing all this stuff. That's really the bigger cost than the actual material.
You mentioned in one of the documentaries that I will link to at the show notes page, workingcows.net/50, that your father viewed or saw the relationships of chemical to agriculture as something like a drug addiction. Is that an accurate depiction of what he had in mind?
Yes, absolutely. Just like a drug addiction that you have to get more and more to get the same kick, and so you're on this treadmill. And of course, we've seen that in the pharmaceutical world, haven't we? With the survivor bugs get stronger and stronger, so you're constantly looking and reaching for a new antibiotic, a new medication, a new vaccine, a new thing, because you've got survivors that have now built up immunities to the medication, and the result is that you've got to continually trying to find new things that are stronger. They always get more expensive. They lots of times they get more toxic. Don't get it on your hands. Don't get it in your hair. Blah blah blah. And so if we can get away from all that, not only does it make the farm a safer place, but it also gets us off of that treadmill. The cows don't build up an immunity to their own immune system. When you're dealing with their issues or their weaknesses, with their own immune system, that's the way you want to do it.
What role does selecting animals that are adapted to your environment play in being able to cut out the chemicals as far as the cows are concerned?
Yeah, well, I think it's a big deal. We do line breeding, so we're saving our own bulls. Probably the guru on this in the world, and maybe perhaps the world, is Kit Farrow out there in Colorado. When he sells bulls, he guarantees that nothing going back 10 generations has had a hand laid on it in helping a birth or a sickness or whatever. Back 10 generations, and he says that if for the last 50 years, if we had never saved a bull from a cow younger than 10, I think is what he says. I may be putting words in his mouth, but you get the idea. If we had never saved a bull from a cow younger than 10, today the beef industry would not have any vet bills whatsoever, because the animals we would have been selecting for vibrant immunological function. The problem is when you go in and you vaccinate and you bring in these medications as crutches, to ameliorate the weaknesses, you don't know who's weak or not. And so if you do a hands-off approach, it sounds to an uninitiated city person, it might sound a little bit hard-nosed, but how are you going to determine who can't walk with a crutch until you quit giving everybody crutches? When you quit giving everybody crutches, then the ones that can't walk with them fall over, and you can call those. But if everybody gets a crutch, and you're standing there looking at this whole group of 100 that has crutches, how do you know who can survive without crutches?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've had Kit on a couple of times, and he's doing some really exciting stuff down there, and I look forward to future conversations with people from Farrell Cattle Company about some of the stuff they're doing with grass-finished beef in Texas and different things like that. We could go on and on and on, and I appreciate your time today. I do want to give you an opportunity to share about anything you've got in the works, anything you've got upcoming, any new books or anything like that that you wanted to share about?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we still try to stay, stay viable. The marketing scene is changing dramatically with Amazon and, dinner in a box and door-to-door delivery and things like that. So the landscape is certainly changing. I am hoping to, get another book out maybe, in the next 8-9 months. And so stay tuned for that. We just keep carrying on here doing the same thing and trying to do better, trying to learn and just do better all the time.
What role does all this play or how much does your theology, let's say that way, how much does your theology inform, all of these decisions that you guys have made over the years?
Yeah, well, I start off with the idea that, God owns it all, right? It's all God's stuff. And so I'm just a steward. I don't own it. I mean, the county says we own this piece of property, but we don't really. We're just pilgrims passing through. And so the question is, if God owns it, A, does he care how it's handled? And B, if he does, how can we handle it the way that would please him, that would give him a good return on investment? Is a dead zone the size of Rhode Island in the Gulf of Mexico a good return on investment for God's creation? Probably not. If I owned the creation, I wouldn't like that kind of return on investment. I'd say, whoa, wait a minute, I want my frogs back, I want my tadpoles back, I want my shrimp back. So, those are the kind of things that we think about and ask for wisdom.
Very, very good. Well, Joel, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and discuss some of your strategies and some of the things that you guys are doing there. It was an honor to speak to you.
Thank you. Well, it's my pleasure, and have a great rest of your day and be an encouragement to others. Wonderful to be with you.
Great stuff there with Joel Salatin. Really appreciate him taking the time to join me today. Really enjoyed my time with him and just some really great stuff that he was able to share with us. Coming up next week on the show, we've got Johan Zietzman. So another great interview. Maybe the flip side of the coin from episode 49. We're talking about grazing cell development in arid land. So look forward to that. Tune in next week for episode 51 of the Working Cows podcast with Johan Zietzman.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.